Coming up, Kim Lawton looks at the moral injuries suffered by many returning U.S. service members and efforts to help them heal. And Lucky Severson visits Catholic nuns in Colorado who say they love both God and the cattle they raise. Plus, Baha'is fasting in spiritual preparation for their new year.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Aid has managed to reach some besieged areas in Syria, thanks to a ceasefire. In Washington this week, humanitarian aid groups called for sustained, unfettered access to Syria.
The scale and the magnitude of the Syrian crisis, the suffering of ordinary civilians, of children, of mothers, continues to astound and shock me.
Meanwhile, the migrant crisis remains acute. Thousands are stuck at a camp on the Greece-Macedonia border. Pope Francis said countries that are on the front line of the migrant crisis need the cooperation of all nations. He called for a unified response to the crisis. The Supreme Court took up its first major abortion case in almost a decade. The justices appeared sharply divided on whether a 2013 Texas law imposing strict requirements on abortion providers should be allowed to stand. The law requires that doctors performing abortions have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. It also requires that clinics meet certain standards. Those opposing the law argue that the restrictions are medically unnecessary and so strict they've led many abortion clinics to shut down. Supporters of the law say it helps keep women safe. One of the highest-ranking officials at the Vatican has admitted that he failed to report suspected child sex abuse to authorities. Cardinal George Pell, a top advisor to Pope Francis, made the confession while testifying to an Australian government commission on child sex abuse. Throughout his 4 days of testimony, Pell admitted he should have done more to protect children, but he also said he had no knowledge in the 60s and 70s of the extent to which the church was covering up sexual abuse. Meanwhile, a grand jury in Pennsylvania has found that over four decades, 50 religious leaders, including priests and teachers, molested hundreds of children in a rural diocese. The grand jury found that superiors who knew of the abuse, including two bishops, failed to notify law enforcement. Because the statutes of limitations on the alleged crimes have expired, the findings will not result in prosecution. Pope Francis has opened a medical clinic for the homeless. The clinic sits next to the shower stalls and barber shop Francis had already opened for the poor in St. Peter's Square. Services at the clinic will be free. In October, Francis converted a travel agency into a dormitory for the homeless. As various presidential candidates vie for the votes of evangelical Christians, some Christian leaders have begun to distance themselves from the word evangelical. They argue political pundits tracking votes this election season have failed to capture the true spirit of evangelicals. Theologian Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention says lately he has begun to describe himself instead as a gospel Christian. Now, a special report. More than 2.5 million U.S. service members have returned from tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, the largest number since the Vietnam War. Many suffer from what's known as moral wounding, a complex set of emotional injuries that are often separate from post-traumatic stress. Kim Lawton reports.
Former Marine Eduardo Lalo Paniagua served in Iraq and the 2010 troop surge in Afghanistan. Coming home after combat was a tough transition, both for him and for his wife, Donna Hernandez. Lalo had suffered physical injuries, but he came to realize there were other, less tangible wounds as well.
As a Marine, you are taught to be tough and not let small things bother you. To me, all the mental issues, the nightmares, the confusion, it was small because my life wasn't in danger. I wasn't being attacked or in an ambush, so it wasn't a problem for me. However, it was affecting my life little by little, and it was affecting my loved ones as well.
Lalo was eventually diagnosed with severe post-traumatic stress, but something else was also identified, moral injury.
Moral injuries have to do with feelings of guilt, shame, anger toward others that's moral, like resentment or indignation. And they're incurred from all sorts of things, but in war there's no shortage of occasions for these wounds to fester.
Nancy Sherman is professor of philosophy at Georgetown University and one of the nation's top scholars in the field of moral injury. In her new book, After War, Sherman explores how veterans like Lalo are suffering from moral injuries. She says the entire nation has a moral duty to help them heal.
I think we have a sacred obligation to our citizen soldiers. This is not a militia. This is us. And so it's morally urgent, just as we send citizen soldiers to war, that we bring citizen soldiers home. And homecomings are really about coming home, figuring out ways to help troops integrate and transition.
Lalo and Donna were high school sweethearts. They grew up in South Central Los Angeles and say they wanted to find a way out of the barrios. For Lalo, that was the Marines.
It just drew me, the brotherhood, the camaraderie, doing something great.
His parents gave him permission to enlist when he was 17 and a half. In 2008, at the age of 19, Lalo was deployed to Iraq. When he returned, Donna was at Georgetown studying foreign affairs. Before Lalo's next tour, the two secretly eloped. Donna was 18, Lalo 20.
We just eloped, and then the next day I had to write an essay, and he had to go back to Camp Lejeune, and a couple weeks later he deployed.
On his 21st birthday, Lalo found himself on a battlefield in Afghanistan, in charge of a unit of 35 Marines, or as he called them, his baby birds. The fighting was more intense than what he had faced in Iraq. Three of his baby birds were killed, two of them in IED explosions.
You never leave a fallen comrade behind. You bring your buddies home. If you're a philosopher, you say these are aspirations. But if you're a young person who has that responsibility on their shoulders, that's not how you view it. You view it as perfect duty, all or nothing.
After he returned from Afghanistan, Lalo says the memories began catching up with him.
At first, I didn't know what was happening. I was drinking every week, constantly, trying to just relax, trying to be alone. I wasn't as social as I used to be. As my wife would say, I was a social butterfly. However, I went very internal. My house was my fortress of solitude.
He'd go months without smiling. He wouldn't go outside. We couldn't go watch a movie because he'd get anxiety attacks because of the dark room, because of all the people surrounding him. It really hurt because it felt like everybody else didn't know the person I knew.
Then one night, things reached a crisis point.
I tossed her halfway across the room in a nightmare, in a sleep. And when I woke up, my wife was crying on the floor, and I'm asking her what's going on, and she tells me, you don't remember, and I'm like, no. She's like, I tried to hug you, and you grabbed me, and you sent me flying halfway across the room. I've been on the floor for the last 4 hours crying. And that's when it was a wake-up call for me.
Lalo went to see a chaplain who asked if he had been to a therapist.
I was like, no, never. Why? I'm okay. I don't need to go see the wizard. That's what we call the therapist. There was, a stigma of if you aren't right in the head, you have to go see the wizard. And if you go see the wizard, your military career is over.
After lots of convincing from Donna, Lalo began intense therapy. He got Max, a service dog specially trained to help vets with post-traumatic stress symptoms. And through Donna's Georgetown connections, he met Nancy Sherman, who helped him see that he had moral wounds.
You hold yourself strictly liable, though you're not really culpable. And you beat yourself up, and you feel the shame of falling short of your lofty military ideals.
Talking to Nancy and her using that moral injury phrase, it really makes me think. I'm like, there are things that happened, things that I feel guilty about that affect me. It's not just the flashbacks that, I mean, nightmares, but the thoughts of feeling guilty for something that happened or for being alive. You know, it's really painful. It hurts.
Giving things a name legitimizes what you're feeling, and it also helps you to kind of explore. Oh, I'm not just thinking about these explosions or torn body parts. I'm actually thinking about my responsibility or someone else's responsibility. War is all about responsibility, and that's the moral piece.
Sherman says acknowledging those feelings as moral wounds is the first step in a very long healing process.
You never fully lose the hurt, the feel, but you own it in a way. And you don't, in the best case scenario, you don't continue to be traumatized by it.
She says another important step is for service members to regain hope in themselves and others.
To be able to have a sense of goodness about yourself, empathize with the good part of you, that's big, that's huge. And so those, and it often takes place not just with yourself, but interactively with other people, interpersonally.
This can begin in the family. Sherman calls Donna Lalo's angel.
She has hope in him. She has trust in him. She knows what he was like before he was rattled by war. And she slowly reminds him of what he was like so he can hold on to that faint image of his good self.
I think one of the sad parts of the story is that a lot of the time when the service members are going through these situations, their family's also going through the situation.
Sherman believes all Americans can play a role in recovery by working toward breaking down military-civilian barriers and building ongoing relationships.
Sometimes a thank you for your service just isn't enough, or it doesn't go beyond that. Be willing to slowly get to know service members.
Now honorably discharged from the Marines, this year Lalo attended Gateway Community College in New Haven, where there's a special Veterans Oasis Center which tries to help returning service members transition to a school setting. It's run by former Marine Rick Polinko.
It gives them a sense of belonging and a sense of comfort and security.
Donna has just earned her master's degree from Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs and is preparing to take on an international posting with the State Department.
Now is kind of my chance to serve the U.S. now that he's been done with his service.
Wherever they end up, Lalo hopes to earn his bachelor's degree.
I want to reintegrate into society. I want to be somebody that could give back to this great nation.
And together, they want to help raise awareness among other vets and their families about the realities of moral injury and the resources available to deal with it.
You never fully recover, you never fully heal. But every day I'm healing more and more, and having her by my side, having her knowing what's going on and being so supportive, it's been great towards the healing factor.
I'm Kim Lawton in New Haven.
Since Kim's story first aired last year, Lalo got a certificate in business administration from Georgetown University's School of Continuing Studies. It has a special program for wounded veterans. The couple has moved to the Dominican Republic, where Donna is working with the U.S. State Department. Max, the service dog, went with them. Now, an interesting juxtaposition. A look at Benedictine nuns in Colorado who not only gather to pray seven times a day, but who also work full-time as ranch hands taking care of their abbey's 80 head of cattle. Lucky Severson visited the St. Walburga nuns.
Near the Colorado-Wyoming border, beneath the snow-covered Mummy Mountains, amongst the grassy meadows, the soothing sounds of psalms being sung by Benedictine nuns, praying for themselves and for the world. Altogether, they pray over 3.5 hours a day. And then in between prayers, rushing out to the corral to rein in the cattle, and the cattle don't always cooperate, this is the Abbey of St. Walburga. It's a working ranch, and the nuns are the ranch hands when they are not praying. And they pray together 7 times a day, always in their habits.
You change your clothes a lot, don't you?
We do.
Seven times a day.
Mm-hmm.
This is Mother Maria Michael. She's the abbess of the Abbey, the Mother Superior to 23 nuns. She says this is not a lifestyle for everyone.
It's a very hidden life. It's not out for the world to see. And so you have to be pretty willing to be hidden and to believe that your life will make a difference, even though you may not be out in the front.
It's a very cloistered life. The sisters rarely leave the ranch. This place may be hidden, but it's not forgotten. The Abbey Retreat is a popular respite. Wayne and Kathy Mayer come here as volunteers, even though they are not Catholics.
I think once you get off of 287 and you come down the dirt road and you see the meadow and you see the snow-capped mountains in the background, it's just a real calming effect.
Wayne Meyer's brother was seriously injured in a car accident. He asked Mother Maria Michael to pray for him, and the Meyers believe that's the reason his brother survived.
You really feel you're praying for the world. You really take to heart when people write to us and ask us to pray for them. We take it to heart their sufferings, and we bring them in prayer, and we ask God to sincerely help them.
Some come here for the grass-fed organic beef, raised gently and so sought after people get on a list to purchase it. The sisters love cows, especially the nun in charge of the ranch, Sister Maria Wahlberger, who has been with the Abbey for 25 years. The cattle know when Sister Warbucka is driving the tractor that hay is on the way.
But the cows, too, keep you rooted. They're beautiful in their own way. We love cows, everyone who works here. But they're also, they're humble animals, and they teach us a lot of patience.
The patience is easy to understand because the cows don't act very humble. The nuns here range in age from 23 to 93. Sister Ann Lee is the youngest. She's been here almost 2 years.
I loved farms and animals and, you know, just nature, but I didn't really associate that with being a nun until I came here.
For Sister Ann, the Abbey ended up at the end of a search for a life with purpose.
Well, you know, I would like to be a spy. I was a firefighter and EMT. You know, there was just so much that I wanted to do. You have to decide. I can't do it all. I'd be a jack of all trades, you know, master of none. So I want to choose the highest one that I can do.
If the smile on her face means anything, Sister Ann has found her calling. All the nuns here say they have been called by God.
You couldn't do it without the call, because it is a hard life, but it's a glorious life.
Many Catholic communities and orders no longer wear traditional black and white habits, but they are the uniform here, and Sister Magdalene Birdlemeyer from the Bronx, who runs a gift shop, wouldn't have it any other way.
People are hungry for the tradition of the church that has women in habits that they can see. There are many wonderful religious sisters who are out doing all kinds of wonderful work. But because they're dressed like everybody else, people don't see them.
We're all human. There's temptations all the way around. But when you're wearing the habit, you understand your actions mean more and that you are responsible for something greater.
I hope no one would ever associate us as being ruler-wielding nuns with, you know, our disciplinarian beating stick.
Sister Maria Gertrude, she's been here 10 years.
Here, we make it our mission to praise God all day long, all night long, with our entire lives, and to also be a place where others can come and find God.
Saint Benedict left the decadence of Rome around 500 AD to lead an austere life. The nuns of the Abbey of St. Walburga fled Germany and the Nazis in 1935 and ended up in Colorado and eventually here in a town that no longer exists called Virginia Dale. The Benedictines' closeness to nature and their manner of prayer dates back hundreds of years.
You get lots of requests from people around
We get so many requests. People call us on the phone with lists of things to pray for. I mean, people are suffering in so many ways. It's very edifying to me to know how they depend on our prayers. I mean, really, they have great faith in us that makes us very humble.
The ranch covers almost 300 acres, all donated, and includes some animals you wouldn't expect.
So one day he gives me a call and says, "Sister, would you milk my water buffalo for me?" I said, "Richard, you don't have a water buffalo." And he said, "Well, I have the opportunity to get one. Would you board it and milk it for us?"
So they milk the water buffalo and make wonderful mozzarella cheese. And now they've got a baby water buffalo named Yoda.
"Everybody's got a water buffalo. Mine is fat, but yours is slow. Where they get them, I don't know. Everybody's got a water buffalo. Woo!"
They also raise bees. That's Sister Gertrude's job, and apparently she's doing it right. Martin Hardison is a master beekeeper who worked all over the world to save the declining bee population.
Here they're thriving. They're doing great. This environment, of course, is completely pristine, you know, and that's a real advantage. You know, they don't use pesticides out in the field.
And then, of course, there's the llama, the watchdog, something that's needed around here. Bears have found the bees and their honey, and the mountain lions are fond of calves.
The cattle were grazing in the hay pastures, and we saw with our own eyes a llama chase a mountain lion out of the field.
The nuns rise before sunup, pray, tend to chores, and do it all over again the next day. And they feel they're experiencing heaven on earth.
You have in the midst here a silence that just breathes in you the greatness of God. There's an immensity you can only grasp in the middle of something so grand.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Virginia Dale, Colorado.
Now, belief and practice. The Baha'i faith, which preaches the unity of all people, began in Persia, now Iran, in the 19th century. There are approximately 5 million Baha'is around the world. They prepare spiritually for their new year with a 19-day fast. We visited a school teacher in Washington, D.C., Abdul Karim Ewing Boyd, as he and his family prepared to break their fast.
The rules for the fast are laid out in the Kitab-i Aqdas, which is the most holy book. From sunrise to sunset, Baha'is above the age of 15 are to refrain from eating and drinking. It's a time for prayer, it's a time for meditation, it's a time for refocusing and concentrating on the spiritual life.
My light is in thee. Get thou from it thy radiance and seek none other than me.
Most people think about the fast in terms of what you don't do. But for me, what the fast is a time for me to reassert my rational spiritual self over my base and physical self. If I'm hungry, I should eat. If I'm thirsty, I should drink. But because of a recognition of a greater and higher need, I choose not to.
Do you have everything on the table?
It's just another way to remind me of my relationship to God and my relationship to my spiritual reality. I'm a spiritual being having a physical experience and not the other way around. There are some things that we do simply because God tells us to do it. That there are some things that are articles of faith. If I can find the ways to make my life a tool for the betterment of mankind as I'm intended by my Creator, then that is a movement towards perfection for me.
The winner of this year's Templeton Prize for his work respecting all faiths is 67-year-old British Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. One of Sacks' greatest interests has been the need for both religion and science. I interviewed him last year.
Science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean.
The Templeton Prize is given each year in recognition of the need for spirituality in today's world. Its founder, philanthropist Sir John Templeton, insisted that the value of his prize each year should exceed that of the Nobel Prizes. This year, that's about $1.5 million. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. Next time, a rare interview with the Aga Khan, spiritual leader of 15 million Ismaili Muslims. He works to build schools and hospitals in some of the poorest parts of the world.
Allah has entrusted to the human race the duty to improve work with his creation.
I'm Bob Abernethy. Join us for the next Religion and Ethics News Weekly.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.